Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We're currently working our way through the book of Revelation in our study of eschatology. Visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
So I have to tell you a brief story before we get started. I came by here yesterday. Tuesdays, here in the building, we have homeschool tutors. So at 1:30, I show up here to drop Megan off. Now I got to tell you a little backstory. The next thing that we need to do to our land out here in order to be in compliance with the plans that we've put in front of the city, if we're going to continue to make the improvements to the property and then eventually build on the piece of land next door, one of the next things we have to do is clear all the overgrowth and shrub and stuff that's back here all the way along the fence and all the way down the side there, because that would be all part of the parking lot, and then we would plant trees at a regular interval, and it's all part of the land use plan and stuff that we've submitted to the city that's been approved. But stuff like that drives me nuts because, you know, it's like paying somebody to clear shrubs and pull up trees and do all that stuff is just, it's more like it ought to be a Saturday where we all get out there and just, you know, hack away and tear down trees. But in any case, so I got here yesterday, I'm dropping off Megan, and a guy walks up and introduces himself to me and gives me his card and tells me he's from the electrical company and says, you know, these high tension wires that run along the edge of our property over there. He says these trees in the back here, the pine trees, are growing to the point where they're going to become a hazard to these wires. And he's been going through the city and cleaning up all of the tree lines and everything else that run concurrent to those wires. And so he said, we're going to have to take those trees down. I said, fine, are you asking permission? And he said, no, I'm telling you, we have to take those trees down. I said, great, fine, take the trees down, fine.
Help yourself.
Yeah, and he said, and that's not a problem. No, no, in fact, I said, as much of that shrubbery that goes with it and as much of that stuff, and he says, well, we have to take all that out. I said, you have to take all that out? Yeah, I have to take all that out. And then we walked the fence line all the way across the back of the property there to the corner of the property on the far end. And I said, okay, now all of this overgrowth from here all the way back, I said, you can take all this out. And he said, well, I probably won't be able to get all of it because it is city tax dollars. We can't do, you know, something that's a benefit to a church with tax dollars. He said, but I think I, you know, as a fire hazard, we can justify most of it. And I said, knock yourself out. Yeah. And then we walked along the property division over there on the far side of that acre. And we walked along there and that overgrowth between our two properties. He said, now, is this your property or theirs? And I said, oh, that's theirs. Well, we got to take that out. What about this? Oh, that's ours. Oh, we got to take that out. They're going to come with stump pullers. They're going to clear that part of the land. They're going to clear all this shrubbery and trees back here. They're going to clear all that, all of which we had told the city we would do as an improvement to the land. And, you know, when we moved in here, we got this land because of those high tension wires.
Yeah.
And so now the land's being cleared for us because of those high tension wires. So, yeah, I got in the car and I was driving away. I just looked up at the sky and I went, I love it when you do that. You know, just like, here you go again. Here's the next thing you're going to need. Yeah, and I couldn't help thinking as I was driving, you know, God never does stuff like that unless he's like preparing something, you know, he's getting ready to do something else. So apparently we'll be building in the not too horribly distant future because he's starting to prep the land. I kind of went, wow, that's so odd. So, really fun. So, all right, turn to Revelation 12. I want to continue the same line of thought that I introduced last week before it has time to escape your brains. Revelation 12 is where I'm going to start. We're going to try to cover as much of Revelation 12 and 13 tonight as we can in sort of a survey fashion, but it's going to pick up on stuff that we already talked about last week. On the board, I have written 1 through 7, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then number 7 is the Ten-Toed Kingdom. Last week, we saw the angel say to John that of these 7 kingdoms, 5 had fallen. Remember that? One is, which was Rome during John's time, and then one was yet to come. And then there was the descriptions of the little horn, and then there was going to be an eighth, which was going to be led up out of the bottomless pit, take possession of the little horn, and then he would go into perdition. Remember all that from last week? Okay. If you don't, just nod. Just, yeah. So this comes up again in chapter 12 and 13 from a different point of view. And one of the statements that I made last week was that the power that comes out of the bottomless pit to indwell the little horn, I said, is the same power that possessed Alexander the Great and gave him the power to conquer that he had. And I said that that same demonic spiritual power of Alexander the Great is going to come around again on planet Earth in the embodiment of Antichrist, little horn, whatever you want to call him. I want to show you tonight where I get that, because it is not just speculation. So Revelation 12, starting at verse 1, there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. Now, the first thing we have to do is interpret that woman. You can find books, you can go on the internet and find two major fields of interpretation of Revelation 12, 1. And the two camps are, they either say that the woman right there is Israel, which I believe and which I will show you in a minute, or that it's the church. If you are an amillennialist, if you are preteristic in your thinking, then you've got to do something with this woman because she is so clearly Israel and she is so clearly predictive of future events that include Israel. So instead they say, well, she is the church. And the thinking is that the church somehow is going to give birth to Christ, since this woman goes on to give birth to Christ, that the church gives birth to Christ in some spiritual way when the church itself goes out into the world and spreads the gospel. And you don't have to look far on the internet to find that interpretation. The church in Franklin that I was part of, that was the standard interpretation of that verse. Let me show you why I interpret it to be Israel. It's the emblems here are so specific. First off, she's female. She's got the sun and moon under her feet, and on her head, 12 stars. Do we see that exact same imagery anywhere else in Scripture? If we do, then we have to interpret her in light of how those emblems are already used and interpreted for us clearly in Scripture. Well, fortunately, the answer is yes. Go back to Genesis 37, and you're going to see those same symbols. Genesis 37. And we'll start around verse, like, 6. This is Joseph dreaming dreams. You will remember that Joseph had a dream where there were sheaves of wheat, and all the sheaves of wheat that belonged to his brothers all bowed down to his sheave of wheat, and they all understood what that meant, that they were going to bow down before him. Well, starting at, like, verse 5 of Genesis 37, Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said to them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed, for behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and behold, your sheaf stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf." And his brethren said, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shall you have dominion over us?" And they hated him yet all the more. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren, and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon, and the 11 stars." Why would there only be 11 in this case?
Because he's the 12th.
He's the 12th. Exactly right. "Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." He told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said, okay, now father's going to interpret for us. "What is this that you have dreamed? Shall I and thy mother," so who's I and thy mother in that emblem?
The sun and the moon.
The sun and the moon. It'd be Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. These are his 12 sons, who was the father of Joseph through his wife, who he loved, Rachel. Right, who he ended up in the tent with Leah trying to get Rachel. So the sun and the moon in this case are the mother and father of Joseph, and therefore the father of all Israel, Israel himself, Jacob himself, right? And the 12 stars then are emblematic of who?
The sons.
The 12 tribes, the 12 sons. Yeah, all 12 tribes, not just the lost ones. 12 stars, 12 sons, 12 tribes, sun and moon, Israel, and the mother of Joseph. You got it?
Yeah.
Okay, now, the Bible just interpreted those emblems for us, right? So I conclude then that when I look at Revelation 12:1, and it says, there appeared a wonder in heaven, a woman, Israel is always referred to in the feminine, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. I'm forced to say that that's national Israel. But then when I read the rest of it, it's inescapable that it's national Israel who's being signified by this woman. Okay? That's what's called letting the Bible interpret the Bible. And there's no way to get similar symbols and say that it's the church somehow anywhere in the Bible. You can't find it. She, being with child, cried, travailing in pain to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his head. Now, we saw that emblem or that symbol, we saw that dragon last week. So it's clearly a symbol of satanically driven kingdoms of the world, these kingdoms that are up here on the board. And the 10 horns symbolize the 10-tone kingdom. And now they introduce 7 crowns. Crowns are obviously kings that rule over these kingdoms. And his tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour the child as soon as it was born. The reference there to the tail taking a third of the stars of heaven down with him is where we get the idea that when Satan fell from heaven, that he took a third of the angelic host with him. We already know from Jesus' own interpretation earlier in Revelation that stars are emblems of angels. So for it to say that his tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth, that's the idea of fallen angels and that a third of heaven fell with Satan. Verse 5. And she brought forth a man-child. Now look at the description of the man-child that the woman brought forward here, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Now that's very familiar language. Who rules all nations with a rod of iron?
Jesus
Christ. There's no other choice. He is the only one spoken of as ruling with a rod of iron. He will rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. So that is the ascension of Christ up to the throne of God. Now, knowing what we know historically, that Christ was the line of the tribe of Judah, and knowing that all through the Old Testament the prediction was through Judah would come the deliverer, the Messiah, then it's clear that this woman is Israel who gave birth to the Messiah who was taken up to God's throne. And the woman, look at this, verse 6, and the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared of God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. How long is that?
3.5 years.
3.5 years on a 30-day per month calendar. That is exactly 3.5 years. Now, the interpretations that say that the woman is the church then have to do a lot of fancy tap dancing and become very allegorical in trying to explain how it is that the church gave birth to Christ. And they say that it is the church in the wilderness, the church going out into the wilderness of the world, being spread out into the wilderness, preaching the gospel of Christ, thereby forming Christ in people's hearts, giving birth to Christ around the world. I read it just again today, and I got very frustrated because I have a tape of a preacher preaching that very thing because I collect that kind of stuff because I'm weird. And I was looking for that tape because I know I have it. And I was going to bring it here tonight and just play it so you could just hear a guy say that so you would know that I'm not just making this up. But that is standard, amill, post-mill, preteristic, any of those groups can't say that this is Israel who has a future 3.5 year protection by God. And yet that's exactly what this passage says.
What did I do with the 3.5 years of preterism?
Well, there is an answer to that. They will say that Daniel's 70 weeks, long as you ask, that when Christ died, that was the middle of the 70th week. That he died at that 3.5 year mark into the 70th week, and that's why it says that the prince who should come will stop the oblation and the sacrifices will cease and that kind of stuff, that when Christ died, all the sacrifices ceased. But they have to be really tricky again to say that because the people of the prince who come also ransack the city and destroy the temple and everything else. So that would be Christians who do that if the prince to come who stops the oblations and the sacrifices is Christ. It's not. It's the little horn, clearly, that's coming to do that stuff, who 3.5 years in causes all that damage and pain. So they will say that it is Christ, and so the Daniel 70th week is 3.5 years in when Christ died, and then depending on their scheme, there's a little break in time till 70 AD, and then the last 3.5 years of trouble, tribulation, time of trouble such as never was, is wrapped up right there. And so that's when the church, especially after the Jews in Jerusalem are scattered out into the world, after the temple falls, that's the scattering of them during that 3.5 year period. So, yeah, it's tricky. You got to do a lot of tap dancing, but that's what they do with it. Look at verse 7. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon fought with his angels and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out. Now we're going to define the dragon. That old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him, presumably into the earth. So if this all happens during that period of 42 months, why would the woman have to flee into the wilderness for 42 months? It's obvious because there's a war in heaven. The devil is cast down into the earth. He and his minions are once and for all cast out of heaven, not to be there anymore, which is why, of course, there would then be 3.5 years of a time of trouble on earth such as never was or ever would be again, because the devil, knowing his time is short, comes down and wreaks all sorts of havoc on the earth along with his third of heaven that came with him. So of course there would be terrible trouble. The great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of the brethren is cast down, which accused them, past tense, before our God day and night. In other words, the devil can't do any more accusing after that point because he's cast out. Now the question is the devil at this moment in heaven, or at least does he have access to heaven in order to accuse the brethren right now? I would contend, yes, he does. You said yes, Jeff. Why would you say yes?
Look at Job. Well, Job.
Right, absolutely.
He's got to give an account.
Right.
Even Satan has to give an account for the Lord, what he's doing. You know
what? Right.
Oh, then in 70 AD, he stopped being able to do that?
Okay, so then that would be my next question. So then when the cross of Christ came, and Christ died on Calvary, and he went up into heaven, did that stop Satan's ability to accuse the brethren to God? And can you prove your point biblically? Principalities and powers and all that, but does that still mean that the devil necessarily can accuse? I would argue that in the book of Hebrews, where the argument is made that Christ is able to save us to the uttermost, the rest of the Pauline theology behind it is, you're already nodding, is because Christ ever lives to make intercession for us. Right. Well, what would be the point of Christ having to make continuous intercession? There can only be continuous intercession if there's continuous accusation. So I contend that the devil is yet still able to, still has access to heaven, and still able to accuse the brethren. Otherwise, there's no point to Christ's continual intercession, which means that this hasn't happened yet. That's my point. It won't happen until Israel, under threat of annihilation by the little horn, by Antichrist, flees into the wilderness. By the way, Daniel told us where she was going to flee. Do you remember where she's going? Where? Moab, Ammon,
and
Edom. It's very clear in the book of Daniel that those are the three areas that the Antichrist will not get to. And so, knowing that, when the time comes to flee, all they have to do is look into their own scripture and know where to flee. Once they see the Antichrist rise up and go, that's just like Daniel said it was going to be. We need to go. They're going to know where.
Why don't they live there now?
Why wait? Avoid the rush.
That's in the middle of the desert.
Well, part of it is that happens to be the exact place where, what's the city? What's the name of the city? Petra. That happens to be where the city of Petra is, which at this point is a tourist attraction. But, you know, if you have a couple million people fleeing there, they will go in there and be protected there. But I think another reason you say, well, why don't they go there now, is I don't think they believe it. I don't think they believe it's coming. Looking at it from a Judaistic standpoint, you're going to say Messiah hasn't come yet. You're still waiting for Messiah to come. And Peter even says there will come in the last days scoffers, saying, where is the coming? Where's the promise of his coming? Because since the fathers slept, which is a very Jewish phrase, referring to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they've always been. So even Peter had to deal with that in the first century. So even more so 2,000 years later, right? Yeah. Okay, so now the great dragon is cast out into the earth. I would say that has not happened yet. He still appears to have access to heaven. I heard a loud voice saying, now is come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of our Christ, for the accuser of the brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him. Who is that? They, the brethren, overcame the devil, Satan, by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time. That's really interesting. You know that the devil quoted Scripture to Jesus, meaning that he is familiar with Scripture, and he's not afraid to use it and twist it to his own advantage. When Jesus came upon the demoniac at the Gadarenes, one of the things that they did was they threw themselves down in front of him, they worshipped, is the word it uses, that they worshipped him, and said, Son of God, have you come to torment us before the time? Which means they even knew that there was a time coming when the torment was going to happen. They were going to be cast into the bottomless pit and into the lake of fire. They knew that was coming, and they knew he was going to be the one to do it, but they knew it wasn't yet. But they knew it was coming. So when the devil is cast out of heaven and has no more access, which by the way means that God can do that whenever he wants, he just hasn't yet, because Satan continues to serve a purpose in God's economy and plan of salvation. But when he tosses him out once and for all, Satan's going to know the clock is ticking. I've got like 3.5 years, and then it's bottomless pit time for 1,000 years. Then I get to come out for a short space, rev up an army, and then it's lake of fire time. And the smoke of the torment rises up forever and ever, is the language. So you can see why, if he gets to earth, he's going to be a little peeved, right? Now I got to ask another question then. Since it says, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, for the devil has come down to you having this great wrath, can the church be here?
Nope.
Woe to you, you inhabitants of the earth. Can the church be on the earth?
No.
Could angels in heaven be saying woe to the church on earth? Absolutely not. That's language that can't possibly be used against the church. So where do we have to be? We have to be up there, because the previous verse says that what they sing up there in heaven is, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. That can't be said, now is come salvation, if the church is still down there on earth dealing with the devil, right? But we'll be okay, because we'll have canned foods and solar panels.
And generators.
And generators. So we're going to be all right. When the devil saw, look at verse 13, and when the devil saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman, which brought forth the man-child. Now that's perfectly in keeping with Daniel's prophecies. The angel Gabriel said to Daniel that the prophecy of the 70 weeks was concerning thy people and thy holy city. The prophecy of the 70 weeks has to do with Israel, and that's what I keep trying to drive home, is that the book of Revelation is a very Israelitish book. If you try to read it through 20th century Christian eyes and say that everything in it has to do with Christians, and everywhere you see elect or saints, you're talking Christians, then you're going to get very, very confused. The church has to be in heaven, and then God turns his attention, as the devil does here, back to Israel. But if you interpreted chapter 12, verse 1, the woman to be the church, then when you get to this, where it says that the devil comes down to earth and persecutes the woman, then you've got the devil coming down and persecuting the church. So you can see where the post-trib folk would go nuts with that interpretation, but they would have to start with a misinterpretation of the woman. And when the dragon saw that he was cast onto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. But to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle. I'm convinced that really all that means, because all the way through the Bible, wings of eagles is protection and speed. And so I would say that that just means that God protects them supernaturally.
Not too big air buses.
That's what it is, two big air buses, which are right now being built by Lockheed Martin. And that's... that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. What is time, times, and half a time?
Three and a half.
Sure. Time is one, times two, half, three and a half. So now you've got three and a half being equal to 1,260 days. And 1,260 days, by a lunar calendar, is exactly 3.5 years. Right? Now, it'd be really helpful if we could also see the Bible call that 42 months. So that's what's coming up in just a minute. Because John really wants us to get the numbers here, apparently. He breaks it down to days, months, and years. We're being real specific here.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Even there, I mean, it's clear where the Bible is being symbolic. You know, like with the,
absolutely,
giving the wings to the woman.
Right.
I mean, where it's clear, like, we're talking days. And stuff. And
days, months, years, and they're all mathematically the same.
You're being all literal, wooden literalism, as they
right.
call it. So
yeah.
Let's just, everything's symbolic.
Yeah, exactly right. I have always said that a face value literal reading of the Bible understands a symbol when they see one. It understands an allegory when it reads one, and it knows when the Bible's making an analogy, because they're so obvious, like you just said. I'm just saying what you just said. Say it again, and I'll just...
straighten it out.
No, I didn't mean straighten it out. I just wonder what else Jeff had to say, and I was just going to keep going. Huh? Verse 14. And to the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, which Daniel already told them what the place was, where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. Throughout the Bible, flood is destruction, war, terror, all of that kind of stuff. So when you read stuff like that, like Jeff was just saying, symbols like... we've already got the wings in there. Now you've got a serpent opening his mouth and a flood of water comes out. That's what John actually saw. We have to say, okay, what John saw was a serpent, open mouth, flood. But all the way through the Bible, flood is a symbol of terror, judgment, trouble, war, problems on earth. So clearly the devil is trying to wipe out the woman. That's the point. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened up her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. That's really, really interesting to me, especially considering the sudden rise in earthquakes in the Middle East around Jerusalem. So clearly that's what it's talking about here. There's going to be an earthquake, and the earthquake and the opening up of the earth is going to be helpful to the woman.
I don't know how far you can stretch that, saying that the earth helped the woman, and I tend to think, like, you know, that even all creation praises the Lord.
Or cries out for the...
For the day of redemption.
Yeah,
sure. But doesn't everything under God's hand ultimately serve his function and purpose? Yeah. Napoleon's armies, when they were steaming up into Russia, if Napoleon had been successful in overtaking Russia, it would have changed all of Middle European history. And what did God use to stop him? Snow. You know, they were steaming up there, here we go, and next thing you know, blizzard, and the army is stopped dead in its tracks. Because God knows how to use the earth to accomplish his purposes. Right? So the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth or angry with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed. Boy, we've seen that language all the way through the Bible, haven't we? The remnant of the seed. Who is the remnant of the seed? It's clearly the remnant of Israel, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, which is very, very interesting language. And we'll get into that as we continue through the book of Revelation, because there's no doubt that you've got the 144,000 who are out there testifying and spreading the gospel of Christ. There's no doubt that you have the final two witnesses who appear after this. So there's no doubt that there is evangelism going on among the Israelites who are still on earth.
But not the left behind. Not the left behind
But they're not the left behind. No, exactly right. It's within Israel. And that's why it says here that they have the law of God and the testimony of Christ, which, by the way, is exactly the way James describes first century Israelite converts. They were zealous for the law, and they had the testimony of Christ. And that's the way they're described here at the end of time, that they have the law of God and the testimony of Christ. So we're talking about converted Israelites, converted Jews here. Chapter 13, then, verse 1, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea." I will tell you, just real quickly, sand of the sea. Where else do you see sand of the sea analogies? Sand of the sea. Where did God bring that up before? Abraham's offspring would be as numerous as the sands of the sea. So then what does sand of the sea mean?
Israel.
Israel, offspring of Israel. Okay. Large, numerous population, Israelitish heritage. "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea." Now, sea itself, throughout the Bible, is representative of large populations. All the population of the earth, the sea encompasses the whole earth. So we're talking about him standing among Israelitish nations and then looking out at the sea nations. Got the contrast? "And I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads," here's a familiar character, "ten horns, and upon his horns, ten crowns, and upon his heads," the seven heads, "there were the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard." So now we got to do a little background work again. In the book of Daniel, Daniel likens three of these seven nations to particular animals. Babylon, he typified as a lion. Remember any of this? You can go back and check the tapes. But Babylon was typified as a lion. Medo-Persia was typified as a bear that rose up on one side and had three bones in its teeth. And the reason it rose up on one side was because eventually the Persian side under Cyrus became more powerful than the Median side, and Darius the Mede, or Darius the Mede, if you're pronouncing things the way the Bible Encyclopedia claims you're supposed to pronounce them. I just saw that the other day and went, I've been saying Darius my whole life. Turns out it's Darius. Yeah. So Medo-Persia is a bear rising up on one side. Greece is a leopard. And in fact, he's a winged leopard at that. So these three kingdoms are typified as a lion, a bear, and a leopard, back in Daniel. So now, verse 2 of chapter 13 says, "And the beast which I saw, rising up out of the sea, was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion." That's very, very interesting because of the particular body parts that are mentioned to correlate with these three kingdoms. He was like a leopard, that's his main characteristic, his main physical characteristic. But his feet, where he stands, is in ancient Medo-Persia. Where's Medo-Persia?
Iraq and Iran.
That's where he's standing. He speaks with the mouth of the lion. He speaks from Babylon. There's a surprise that, of course, he would spout that same mystery religion that has always been coming out of Babylon and Babylonish mystery religion. "And the dragon gave him his power," so the devil, already identified, gives him his power and his seat and great authority. So now we've got a guy who, as an embodiment, comes out of Greece, which I've already told you, because he's called the King of the North, he has to come out of the Seleucid portion of the ancient Alexandrian kingdom, which puts him in Iraq, Iran, Transjordan, Turkey, that part of the world. That is the Seleucid portion that was called the King of the North. And it's directly out of the King of the North that the little horn comes. So, of course, that would bring him out of Greece. That's exactly where he came out of. And where's he going to stand? Right there in the Seleucid portion, Iraq, Iran, that area. And then he's going to speak from Babylon. So this is very consistent from Daniel to Revelation. Same concepts. Except that in Revelation, it takes the Daniel information and thrusts it out into the future, 92, 96 AD forward, so that we see that it's yet to happen. "And I saw," man, this is the verse that Can't tell you how many books have been written and how many theories and how much speculation there has been about this. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Remember when Reagan got shot? And everybody waited to see, oh, what if he rises up? Remember when the Pope got shot? Oh, and he rose up and his deadly wound was healed. I mean, people just speculating. Just a couple years ago, John Hagee put out a book, and that's what he said, that we're going to know who the Antichrist is because he's going to take a deadly wound. In fact, he says he's going to be shot in the head. That's his term, going to be shot in the head, and his deadly wound is going to be healed, and because it's a miraculous healing, everybody's going to go, well, it's a miracle. He's been shot in the head and raised up again. Clearly, he's, you know. In Left Behind, Carpathia gets shot in the head. Oh, exactly. That's the theory. Okay. Now, let's go back. On the seven-headed beast, what are the heads?
Kingdoms.
They're kingdoms. Okay. So one of these kingdoms has a deadly wound. One of the heads, which is one of the kingdoms, was wounded to death. It doesn't say shot in the head. It doesn't say that anywhere. It says one of the heads representing one of the kingdoms has a deadly wound. Now remember what we read last week. Five are fallen. One is. And the one that was, is not, and is to come is in the was category. One of these five, one of the rulers of these five kingdoms, was not during John's time and is going to rise up again. Remember all that? One of these heads gets a deadly wound, right? Deadly wound. He was dead during John's time. Is not during John's time. And will be again when the deadly wound is healed and that kingdom or the force behind that kingdom is going to rise up again. That's the correct, proper interpretation of that verse. And all those sensationalistic books about there being some world leader, especially if he's European, and especially if he's Nordic and blonde, and gets shot in the head, and then heals, he's the Antichrist. The Bible doesn't say that. It says one of these kingdoms is wounded, dead during John's time, and going to rise again, which is exactly what we read last week, that the beast that was and is not and will come out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. It's the same imagery. I saw one of the heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, Satan, which gave power unto the beast. Now look at that. All the world wondered at the beast and worshiped the dragon. Can the church be here?
No.
If all the world wonders after the beast and worships Satan, can the church be here? It's impossible that the church is here. Is Israel worshiping the beast?
Yeah.
No, I would say not.
But they're still here, right? On Earth.
Yeah, but they're the remnant. Yeah, because throughout the book of Revelation, there is always distinction made between the world and the remnant. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that no, the remnant doesn't worship the beast. However, some of them are going to end up losing their head over that testimony. So while all...
So Israel right now?
In hiding. The remnant at this point is in hiding, Edom, Moab, Ammon, 42 months, 1,260 days, being fed, taken care of in the wilderness, while this is happening to the whole rest of the world. Now, by the way, there is a precedent for this, what I just said. When Moses went to Pharaoh and said, let my people go, at the time the Israelites who were in Egypt had a territory of Egypt where they lived, they were in the land of Goshen. And when God sent down plagues, when there was darkness, there was light in Goshen. When there was plague of frogs, no frogs in Goshen. When the hail fell, didn't fall in Goshen. When the death angel passed through, only Israel was told to put the blood up, and the blood on the door post kept their family safe while the death angel came through the camp and killed all the other firstborn. So there is a precedent for God cursing an area with plagues and death and trouble while at the same time protecting his remnant.
Okay?
Really good question, by the way. And all the beast, and all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast, and who is able to make war with him. Let me point out, too, long as we just made all these points about the lion, the bear, and the leopard, it's clear then, since he's coming out of the Medo-Persian area, and since his background is a leopard Grecian background, and he's the deadly head that used to be and rises up again, which is what leads me to believe that he's, again, that Greek power coming back up, that undermines all of the left-behind John Hagee sensationalistic books that will tell you that the ten-nation kingdom to rise up at the end of time is a European confederation. All of those books, to the letter, will tell you, watch Europe, because they're hung up on Rome, and they're looking for a reconstitution of the Roman Empire. And so anytime they see alliances of nations in Europe, they're saying, that's the Roman Empire, and so there you go. And they've really been keeping an eye on the EU, the European Union, which now is up to, what, 13, 14 members, something like that. So it kind of hit 10 and kept going. And in fact, there were a couple books, once they hit 13, that said, oh, well, he takes 3 by 4s, according to the book of Daniel. So he takes the 3 by 4s, and then the others give him the power, making 13. And they're having to work so hard and twist so hard to follow the thought that it's a European thing. And as I think we've seen repeatedly from Daniel and Revelation, it's coming out of the Middle East. The Antichrist is Middle Eastern, he's going to be Muslim, and he's going to be an ancient enemy of Israel. Because this whole thing, this whole Bible, is about God's dealings with Israel. So why would there suddenly be a 10-nation European Union, and then America flies in, and then there's war between America and Europe, and all those books. And there was given unto him, this is verse 5, there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Well, thanks, John. So 42 months equals 1,260 days equals a time, and half a time. It's a 3.5-year thing. And it starts with Satan being cast out of heaven. So Satan is cast out of heaven, and then there's 3.5 years of trouble on earth. And we also know from Paul's writing in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians that the Antichrist will be known by the fact, well, and Daniel even tells us that the 70th week begins with the restitution of a pact that allows Israel to rebuild the temple, rebuild the streets. That was the deal that was made by Cyrus, that was reconfirmed during the time of Nehemiah through Artaxerxes, and that is exactly the deal that Daniel references to say that the 70th week will start when there is a deal made that they can rebuild the temple. So you will know that the 70th week has happened when there has been a departure, and then that man of sin has been revealed. That's 1st, 2nd Thessalonians. And then he goes into perdition. And then he sets himself up in the temple, showing himself that he is God. Well, that's all Paul's writing. So you've got Daniel predicting these things, you've got Paul saying they're coming, and then you've got John on Patmos describing them the same way and identifying the area that it's going to come from. I just don't know how people, how can you miss this? How can you, it's just so pervasive in Scripture. So there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. Power was given unto him to continue 3.5 years. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. Look at that. Blaspheme his name and his tabernacle. So what does that mean to you? There must actually be a tabernacle. There has to actually be a temple in Jerusalem in order for him to blaspheme it. There has to be a temple there for Paul's prediction to come true when Paul said that he goes into the temple of God showing himself that he is God. There has to be a temple there because Daniel says that he goes in and profanes that temple. Jesus says in Matthew 24, when you see the abomination of desolation in the temple, then you know it's time to flee into the wilderness. So it is unavoidable that there is yet a temple to come in Jerusalem, and it will be built when this character makes a pact with Israel to build the temple. And for 3.5 years, they're going to build the temple, which you can go to a website called the Temple Mount Faithful and read about the fact that they already have all the furniture, they have the temple in prefab state, they're ready to go. 3.5 years is nothing. They could have it up in 6 months and already be sacrificing animals. So he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, blasphemy in his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints. And that's where, again, people will jump up, if you're writing Left Behind books, and say, see, there have to be saints for him to make war with. Except the word saints means what?
The set aside.
The set aside ones. The hagias. It is the ones who are set aside for God's personal use. So is Israel the chosen elect of God set aside for God's personal use? He just referred to them as the remnant. Well, yeah. So what saints is he making war with? The very ones we just read that he goes and makes war with the woman. Same ones, same thing. There's nothing in that verse that says the church is still here. But
at the end of verse 6 there, I was noticing that the NASB, which I really like, but threw a little interpretation here. With it, that is, they said he blasphemes against God, blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. In other words, saying the tabernacle is those who dwell in heaven. Of course, and then they put it in italics because that is.
Right, it's not even in the text, so but we just thought we'd throw it in because as long as we're interpreting.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're translating, let's interpret too. Interesting. At least I'm glad that they put it in italics, so you'd at least know that they just pitched it in there. It's given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. Jennifer? Oh, okay. And since you brought that up earlier.
And the saints are, is it Israel that was?
Saints are Israel there, absolutely. Again, don't get hung up on the word saint. That is an English translation of the word that's actually being used there. The Greek word, hagios, is the same word that means sanctified. It's the same word that means holy. It means those that are set aside for God's use. Right, Jeff?
Sure.
Yeah.
What was the other word you used? You used another word, too.
So what did I call them? The saints, the hagios, the set aside.
The remnant.
The remnant. Oh, yes. Well, that's what they were called earlier in this same passage, that they are the remnant of God. And by the way, if you are the remnant of God, remnant means the ones left. The remnant of a piece of cloth is the last piece of that kind of cloth, right? So if God refers to them as the remnant on earth at that point, then they're the last of the of his chosen people on earth, except for the church, which of course is worldwide, and there's millions of them still on planet earth, and it still doesn't work. So they're not the church.
Right.
They're Israel.
When he takes the church.
Any Israelite who believes is the church, right?
Okay.
And let's define terms again. They are the ecclesia. When we say church, it's this Greek word ecclesia, the outcalled ones. Mm-hmm. So they are the ones who are called out to Christ specifically so that Christ would have a people for his name. But Israel is not the bride of Christ. Israel is betrothed and married to and divorced and going to be brought back to God. So God the Father refers all the way through the Old Testament to Israel as his wife. In fact, two sisters. God is married to these two sisters. And that while one of them went a-whoring, the other one didn't change her ways, and so he divorced Israel and protected Judah for a while. But the book of Hosea says that he is then going to bring her back. He had Hosea go out and marry a whore. And then she went back to her whoredoms after delivering some kids. And then God says, I'm going to build a hedge around them. I'm going to woo her back. And then he defines it at the end of the book of Hosea, so will I do with Israel. I'm going to do all this. And he hasn't since done it. So think of Israel as God's erring wife. And then he made sure that his son would have a bride, the church. Two different groups of people, two different relationships. Have they lost their sense of who they are? Yes, absolutely. That's what's happened in the northern 10 tribes, yes. When you see Jews returning to Israel right now, that's Judah and Benjamin. Those are the only people who were ever historically called Jews. So you're seeing Judah and Benjamin returning to Israel. Huh?
And just 12,000 of them will be there.
Well, 12,000 of each.
Right, but I'm just saying, not all, there's a lot of them over there.
I don't think the 144,000 are the same as the remnant. I think the 144,000 are the evangelists that go out to evangelize the remnant. Yeah, I think they're a different group.
Okay.
Otherwise, the remnant is exactly 144,000, which is awfully small compared to as many stars as the sky and sands of the sea. And yes?
Okay, so when you were talking about earlier, the converted Jews, when you were talking about that, are they on planet Earth right now? I mean, like, not
right now.
I mean, right now, what we're reading.
Yes, because it says they have the law and the testimony of Christ
right.
while the remnant
so
is hiding.
So they're there too, but they're not in hiding.
No, they're in hiding. Yeah,
they're in hiding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. The remnant is in hiding.
Believed on Christ.
But they also they have the law and the testimony of Christ,
okay.
which I believe happens through the testimony of the witnesses. Look, when Moses and Elijah come back, that's pretty strong evidence.
Yeah.
And they come back preaching Christ after they see 144,000 who didn't even know who they were, who had lost their heritage, who get the mark of God in their forehead. And when the demon locusts come to planet Earth and can hurt everybody, they can't touch the 144,000. Pretty good evidence that God is working on their behalf. So there's going to be a strong inducement among the Israelites to believe in Christ. They're going to have the law and the prophets, Moses and Elijah, the ones that were up on the Mount of Transfiguration, come back to Israel and say, now, like I was telling you, and tell them about Christ. There's an awfully strong inducement to believe going on there. Right? Okay.
In Romans 9, where he's talking about the blinding of Israel, and he wraps up Romans 9, he says, and Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sands the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, it is the remnant that will be saved. The Lord will execute his word upon the earth thoroughly and quickly.
Yep. God is going to save the remnant of Israel and take them into the millennium. And then, just like he did with Noah, just like he told Moses he would do, and he said, I'm going to wipe them all out, start over with you. God's going to take the remnant of Israel into the millennium, start again. The kingdom is going to happen. The kingdom that was always promised. The same kingdom that Jesus said to the Israelites that were alive at his time. He said, the kingdom will be taken from you and given to a nation that will bring forth the fruits of it. He didn't mean a different nation. The nation Israel, a generation of this nation that will bring forth the fruit of it, is actually going to see the materialization of the kingdom. So again, this is very, very consistent all the way through Scripture, as Jeff just pointed out of Romans 9. So are you getting a sense yet that the biblical writers all consistently believe the same thing? Because these threads are woven all the way through all of the different authors of the Bible. And it's so consistent that I'm just absolutely driven to the position I hold. So, verse 6, we got to get done here. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given to him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So who are they that are dwelling on the earth worshiping him? All them whose names are not written in the Lamb's book of life from the foundation of the world. That's why they're able to worship the beast. According to Paul, again in Thessalonians, it says that God will send them a strong delusion so that they will believe a lie and be damned. That's how in control God is of this whole thing. That because they had no love of the truth, he will send them a strong delusion, they will believe a lie and all be damned. And that's in the context of those that follow the Antichrist, the little horn. So all them that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Now there's two ways to read that phrase. It either means that their names were written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, which can be validated by other verses in Scripture, that we were chosen in him before the foundation of the world. Ephesians 1 certainly validates that reading. Or that our names are written in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain from the foundation of the world, in which case Christ was determined to be the sacrifice to save his people before the first person was ever made, so that obviously the fall by Adam into sin and the necessity of a Savior was no big surprise to God because he had already had the Redeemer in place before the foundation of the world. Are any of you in this room, are you familiar with the terms supralapsarianism and infralapsarianism? Not words that show up in cookbooks. All that is, all those big words, supralapsarianism, infralapsarianism is an argument, again, within Calvinistic versus Arminian circles about the plan and the knowledge and foreknowledge of God. Did he know that man was going to sin, and therefore the fall of Adam was part of his divine plan? Or did God put man on the planet, leave them to do as they were going to do, and if Adam hadn't sinned, the world would have continued in the pristine state that God intended? But since he fell, God kind of went into plan B and sent his son to save and redeem a fallen world that God didn't either know was going to happen or hadn't planned on it going that way. The supra, which means above, lapsarian, the lapse, the supra-lapsarian view says that God knew before the lapse happened that the lapse was coming, and therefore even the lapse was part of his plan. Infralapse, the lapse inside the lapse, means that God put them on the planet, they fell, and then God began the work of redemption in response to man's fall. I would then be, obviously, a supralapsarian. I think this verse pushes you to that position, which is the only reason that I would bring up great big words like supralapsarianism. But among theological circles, when they have nothing better to do, they have to make up great big words so that they can argue about them. So, they that dwell on the earth shall worship him whose names were not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If you read it that way, that Jesus is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, then you're saying that God had the fail-safe in place, knowing that the fall was coming, and that the fall itself served his purpose in glorifying his son, who was guaranteed promise to have a people, and he would have those people by redeeming them, that the plan was always in place. Verse 9, if any man have an ear, let him hear. See, that's where the whole problem is right there. That pretty much wraps up the difficulty right there. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. In other words, hold on. You're going to be under a lot of struggle and trial. Yes, the Antichrist is coming. Yes, there's going to be trouble on the world. But trust me, justice is going to come of this. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon, and that's where we'll pick up next week. All right. We'll introduce you to the false prophet next week.
Question.
Yeah.
The NIV at the start of verse 8 says, all inhabitants of the earth who will worship the beast. Does all inhabitants of the earth include the remnant of Israel?
I don't know.
That's what she was getting at. No, I would say because of the distinctions in the language throughout the book, especially through Revelation, the distinction between all the world and remnant. I would say no, that the remnant cannot worship the beast, because ultimately all those that worship the beast end up taking his mark in their right hand or forehead. And then at the white throne judgment, Revelation 21, all those that have that mark end up in the lake of fire. So there's no way that the remnant can end up in the lake of fire. So I would say all the world means all the not remnant.
So that's where you have to step away from the literal reading of the Bible.
No, I would say that that's
well,
an...
He continues on. He said, those who dwell on the earth will worship him.
Whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Right. Would you not argue that the remnant have been written in the Lamb's Book, or that God knew he was going to save them? And I don't think we're saying that we're stepping away from a literal reading. I think the literal Greek usage of the words all and world throughout the Bible have many different meanings.
Well, yeah, that's where it opens up.
Right. Right. I mean, the meanings of cosmos. John alone, James White just pointed this out the other day. John has 14 different definitions for the word cosmos in the way he uses it in context. Whether you're talking about Jesus saying, I pray not for the world, or whether you're talking about, for God so loved the world, or whether you're talking about John in his epistle saying, love not the world or the things in the world. You've got different nuances, colors, and stuff going on there. So if you're going to say all the world, especially if it's the way John uses it, love not the world and the things in the world, then he's talking about non-saints, non-remnant, those who don't love God, right?
Sure.
If Jesus says, I pray not for the world, I pray for those that God gave me out of the world, he's made a distinction between those that are his and the world. Well, the same John wrote Revelation and talks about remnant and world. So it's not a non-literal reading. It's a looking at the context and word usage by John and recognizing that his use of cosmos is in contrast to those who are gods. Right? So, good question too. Pardon me? Yes, if I say so. Yeah. I thought I backed that one up pretty good off the top of my head. All right, anything else?
I kind of got into a little, I wouldn't say heated conversation, but...
yeah, you would.
I felt a little defensive about a customer who came into the tanning salon one day last week. We started talking about religion. I don't even know how in the world it happened, but it did. And it came up, and she went... you're not a Calvinist, are you? And I was just like,
yeah.
I told Shana, I said, I felt like that was the first time I actually been crucified right there.
Yeah, right, right.
Never been, yeah. You know. But I was okay with it because, you know, sure. I was like, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But she kept spouting off, you know, bits and pieces of scripture that absolutely did not, that were just not truthful. And
right. Didn't do you any damage at all, right?
It was so funny because she said, God is love. And mm-hmm. she was clearly infralapse.
Infralapsarian.
Yeah.
There you go. You should have said to her when she said, you're not a Calvinist, you said, you're not an infralapsarian.
And it was just funny because I told Shana, I said, you know, it just made me, because she kept saying, God is love and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I just want to go, well, what about, you know, all the people that God killed? I mean, right. and then like right here, it says, whose names are not written in the book of life, the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Yeah.
I mean, how selective is that?
I mean, she thinks, honest to God, you know, that we have a choice. And
right.
That, I mean, and it's yep. just, I finally just went, oh, I think I've lost my keys, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I just completely dropped it.
Did I leave the gas on?
Yeah. I lost my cell phone.
Do you smell that? That's someone in one of those tanning things. I got to go.
Yeah.
No, there isn't. There isn't. And you know why? You know why? Because you're starting at the end game. Think about how much time you have invested in learning the word. So that you...
Not really enough. I mean,
but you've got this working knowledge going on now, and you've got the big picture, and you've got a framework to work with. You've got passages like that. She doesn't have any of that.
But now we're going to have to hide from her because, you know, she's now going to be trying to, you know, really beat up on us because...
She told her the trouble with us was we must have never read the New Testament.
Okay, that's
exactly the trouble.
Just remember, two chapters, Ephesians 1 and Romans chapter 9.
Yeah. But that's the way, Shane, that's the way they always do it. They argue with me that way. I mean, they tell me that when I finally mature as a Christian, I will understand the mistakes of my position. You know.
And she also said that, her mom was one of those type people.
Right, sure.
She beat her, too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, she didn't chase her down with
There was a guy, many years ago, there was a guy in Dover, and I've told this story, and if you've heard it, tough. And there was a guy who came up to me in the little grocery store there, and he said, are you one of those people that meets up there in that trailer up on the... I said, yeah, I'm one of them, because they took a double-wide trailer and converted it into a church, and I would go up there and preach to them on Sundays. And I said, yeah, I'm one of those people. In fact, I'm the preacher up there, you know? And he said, well, I heard y'all are Calvinists. And I said, do you know what a Calvinist is? And he said, yeah, it's people who think there's only one way to heaven. And I said, okay, you got me. I'm a Calvinist then. Yep.
Thank you for joining us for this week's study. We invite you back next week for another Salvation by Grace message.